Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to another episode of the How I Quit Alcohol podcast. For first-time listeners, please be aware that not all of the conversations within this podcast are suitable for children. I'd also like to add a trigger warning that sometimes the conversations can get a little heavy. We may talk about things like sexual abuse, domestic violence, drug use, and alcohol use. And if you feel that that may trigger you, please do not tune in. Also, I'd like to add, if you are a heavy daily drinker, please seek the help of a medical practitioner before quitting alcohol. This podcast comes to you from beautiful Bundjalung country. Please kick back and enjoy, grab yourself your favourite alcohol-free bevy, and if you haven't already, do a gal a favour, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Hi, and welcome back to How I Quit Alcohol. Today in the Zoom room, I'm so super excited for this next guest. She is a anger management specialist. She's a collector of education, of bachelor degrees and diplomas and all the things. She's also on her way to becoming a recovery coach. She's 4 years sober and is just so full of amazing information. I love everything that she offers on her Instagram. And also, she's the host of the Sober Powered podcast. She's just an amazing unit of a person. So Jill Teets, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for the lovely intro.
Thank you. My bum was so tight while I was doing that. I'm just like, oh, get it right. There are so many more things I wanted to say about you, but I'm like, I'm not going to fit it all in, or I'm going to stuff it up. So thank you. I can relax my bum now.
We can both relax.
Yes. Tell us a bit about your journey with alcohol, Jill, where it got started and what got you to the point where you wanted to stop.
Yeah, so I started at 22, actually.
Wow, that's late.
Yeah.
How old are you now?
I'm 33.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It was quick.
It was very quick. So why did you start so late?
Because I was obsessed with being thin first. And you can't, like, those two just didn't go together. I knew that if my goal was to be thin, drinking a bunch of alcohol was not going to help me reach that goal. So I just never really considered it a possibility for me. And I was always bullied for middle and high school. So I never had opportunities to drink when I was younger. So then I went to college without ever drinking, and I just kind of continued.
So with the bullying, were you kind of pushed out of all the social circles?
Yeah, not invited to stuff, not included in groups, like the even simple things like at the bus stop, all the kids on my street would make like a circle to chat while they waited, and like I wasn't allowed in the circle. Oh. They would sing songs about me sometimes on the bus, not in a nice way.
Oh my God. Why? What? I mean, oh, kids are so awful, aren't they? Was that an ongoing thing since primary school, or that just started later in high school?
No, so we moved in between fourth grade and fifth grade, and we didn't even really move far. Like, I just changed school districts. I was still in the same town. So I just went to the middle school that my elementary class did not go to. So I was with a whole new group and I was not accepted. But elementary, I was friendly and social and out, like I was a little girl that would run up to you and be like, "Do you want to be best friends?" And then they would say yes, and then we'd be best friends. But then, so I just thought that that would kind of continue, and it did not. And then high school, there were some moments of bullying, but a lot of it was just kind of being ignored and left out, and you start to expect that kind of treatment, so you don't put yourself out there either.
Wow. Oh, that's so heartbreaking, isn't it? Like when you hear about that and children going through that, it just breaks your heart. Oh, okay. And so being on the outside, obviously, and then not being invited, in some ways, I guess it's a blessing in terms of that you didn't
Yeah.
weren't drinking. And what was the home life like at home if you were hanging out with mum and dad most weekends, I'm assuming, or how did it look for you on weekends?
Yeah, so that wasn't that good either. Hence the anger. So my parents had a really bad marriage, but stayed married. So I was kind of exposed to all of that. And then my mom would drink to cope with the unhappiness. So I observed that was really the first drinking that I saw. I think a lot of us see the kind of cooler, more romanticized drinking, and we're like, "Oh, drinking is cool when you're a grown up. I want to do that." I call it sad drinking. Like, I didn't want to do that. That didn't look any fun to me. So that was also why I didn't drink until later. So it was a lack of opportunity. It was the drinking that I observed that I wanted nothing to do with. And then in college, I got really into like being thin. So I didn't have any interest in starting to drink.
Wow. And so watching mum drink like that has obviously given you a like, oh, stay away from that. I can kind of relate to that in some ways. What was the sense that you had of yourself? So to be pushed on the outside with those kids and to kind of feel a bit, I'm assuming, probably a bit isolated as well in the home life as well, it must have been extremely lonely.
Yeah, I felt first I was upset that it was happening and I couldn't understand. And then you start to internalize it and think like, well, I'm the common denominator in all of these situations that are continuing to happen. So it must be a me thing. And then like that social outgoing little girl went away. And I changed and I never put myself out there. And even in college, like it took almost 2 years for me to feel really comfortable just being myself again because I just expected people to react to me the same as they did before. It was really rough. I just thought there must be something wrong with me for nobody to like me.
Oh, that just kills me. I'm just like dying over here. It's so awful. The wanting to be thin, what was that all about? Was that to kind of gain acceptance? What was that?
I don't fully know like the motivator. I grew up with a lot of diet culture and just like women who wanted to be thin and went on diets all the time. So I just kind of like thought I should diet too. I had really bad body image that started pretty young. Like right around when the bullying started is when I started to look at my body and feel like this doesn't look good. And then it got worse as I got older. And as I would have more bad experiences in my life, I didn't know what to do with it. I never learned any coping skills or had any modeled for me. So I just tried to like grasp onto whatever I could. And that was the only one that I knew. So I would just try to control food or control exercise to get that feeling of relief or power. It didn't work that well because you gotta eat. So, when you try to restrict a lot, it usually triggers some binging, which then triggers shame. And it's a horrible cycle, but I did it for a long time and I yo-yoed and it was rough, but that was all that I knew like how to do. I didn't know what to do with my emotions, and I was constantly overwhelmed all the time, like randomly. I mean, it felt random. Now looking back, it wasn't random, but I would get overwhelmed frequently, and I couldn't understand what I was feeling or what to do about it. So I would just do self-destructive things to just try to cope in some way and make the overwhelm go down. And then that's eventually what drinking became for me. It did it way better than messing around with food. Like once I discovered drinking, I was like, wow, I understand why people do this. And then it was just bad.
It was, I could imagine once you open that Pandora's box and you get some relief. No wonder. It makes sense, doesn't it? Also, do you feel like that the looking at your body and going, okay, this looks bad, is also a way to also help rationalize the reason as to why you're being rejected as well? Like, is it like they're rejecting me? I've got to try and find something, especially because it would have been so confusing if you'd been so friendly and open with people in the past and then you're getting rejected. Was it also a source of trying to find something to pin it on the rejection?
Yeah, probably. And I would scrutinize my face and the clothes that I wore, just like you said, trying to find what that thing is that's wrong with me, or the collection of things, maybe, so that I could fix it. And I also think it was a distraction. This is a theme for me. And now, like, knowing what I do for work, it probably makes a lot of sense. But I used to do a lot of research projects when I was younger on like how to get thin, like how to lose weight, how to eat less. Like I would just spend hours and hours and hours of time researching these things. And then eventually when I was drinking, the research project would be like, how do you moderate your drinking? How do you know if you're an alcoholic? So I feel like it took time away from thinking about what was going on. And I could just redirect my energy, not into something good, but into something that made me feel like there was some level of control in my life.
And so when you first drank, was that in a social setting?
Yeah, well, my very first drink was when I was 18, but then that I didn't really drink, maybe like a drink here or there, but barely at all. When I actually started drinking for real, it was when I was 22. I had just went to grad school and the environment was different. In undergrad, people like there were parties, but I was a chemistry major, so we just kind of studied together and hung out. We didn't party. And not to say that science people don't party, but when I went to grad school, what I saw is everybody did it. So you would go to classes and then you'd do a bunch of lab work all day. So it felt like a 9 to 5. And then everybody would go to the bar after. And I was actually very secure in myself not drinking. I was confident. I didn't think I needed a drink for any reason. I dated without drinking all the time. I was totally fine. People drinking around me, like I never felt pressure. But when I went to grad school, it was different. I felt like it was very cliquey, and the professors were also very cliquey with the students. And there was a lot of drinking at the school. Like there were parties, and the professors would party with us. People had alcohol on their desks. We would go out to the bars. And I realized, like, I'm the only one that doesn't drink. And I thought, I'm gonna get rejected again, and not included in the social group if I don't do this too.
Wow,
So
and that
that's what really started it. And then I didn't even know how to drink. The person next to me would order something, and I'd just be like, oh, get that too. And like I said, it happened fast once it happened, but I don't know, maybe the second or third time I got a buzz on, and I was like, oh, this is the best thing ever. I have never experienced anything better than this thing. And then I had the opportunity now to do it all the time because people would go to dinner every night at the bar There would be parties. We had every Tuesday night, even in the school, was like a pizza and beer thing for the grad students. So I had so much opportunity and I had so many problems brewing in me from my whole life that had never been dealt with and no coping skills. And it was like instant problem, like no off switch. I had no understanding of how much was too much. I was messing up very quickly, embarrassing myself. It was a whole thing.
Wow. What did it look like for you, the messing up, the embarrassing yourself, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah. So I would call it messing up, but really it's just like getting way too drunk or getting blackout drunk. I was very prone to blackouts, actually. And it also usually involved getting sick in public places, like in a parking lot or in the street or on the subway platform, like just so embarrassing. And I couldn't understand like what was going on really. I saw everybody else doing it, so I just thought that it was normal. And then I decided to leave the program at the end of my first year. And the chair of the department, he told me, no one has any confidence that you will succeed. And no one, meaning like all of the professors that I've interacted with and admired for the past year. And I really valued education and doing well. I was always a good student. And that broke me. And then the only coping skill I knew of was alcohol. So that really spiraled it. Like I started day drinking alone with no food. And then I would just like go home like normal. And like all the time I would go out and I'd get way too drunk and like throw up. And right after that, like a couple months later, my husband and I got engaged. So we moved in together. And now I really had opportunity because I wasn't living at home anymore. So I just started drinking every day. And then it doesn't go well after that.
No.
So it was a lot of lack of opportunity and then like way too much opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. It makes so much sense too when you think about the amount of internal pain that you would have been experiencing from all the, all of that rejection and even from the home life, that as soon as you had that kind of magic elixir, it was just like, yes, especially probably at such a late stage in life, it's just like it would have almost been felt more intense, I imagine, rather than this kind of gradual building up to it. And I just feel so much like, oh my gosh, this, and you know, and not having the coping skills, like you said, to deal with those wounds, I could see why you would just keep on doing it, just to keep pushing it down. It makes sense, especially as you say, when you realize that the trying to control the food is definitely a lot more difficult and probably not as, wouldn't feel as good as the drinking. Jill, were you ever feeling like this is a problem? Like when you were waking up, having blacked out, embarrassing yourself, were you feeling like this is not good? This needs to stop?
It took me a bit. It took 2 years to realize or to start questioning it, actually. So after I left grad school, I had intended on working in the sciences, but that comment really destroyed me. And then,
sorry, why did he say that? Was it because of your drinking or was it because of your, what, like, what was that? Why did he say that?
I don't know. So there was an issue with funding where they accepted too many PhD students and then they needed to get rid of some of them. So they were kind of trying to push some out, but I don't know, like I was already gonna go, like just let me go. I don't know why that was necessary. And it was pretty shocking based on like my experience and looking at how other people did compared to me. I felt like it really was not deserved. So I don't know why that was said, actually.
And it's another rejection again. for you. No wonder you spiraled out of control more after that.
Just yeah, hit the that biggest wound. Rejection.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you've moved in with your partner, now husband, and now you've just kind of, was he drinking a lot as well?
Yeah, but he's never had an issue. He could drink and party and then stop and have a glass of water and take care of himself.
Okay, one of those people.
Yep.
Damn them. Show offs. Yep. Yeah.
Yep, okay. I know. I had started teaching, actually. I became a science teacher and a math teacher. And it's a very stressful job to teach. So the only coping skill I knew for stress was alcohol. And that's when like things accelerated even more. And the thing that made me finally start questioning my drinking was I'd like go to work. I'd come home every night and like get drunk and I'd black out multiple times a week. I'm a big video gamer and I would black out playing Tomb Raider. And then the next night I'd turn on my game and I'd be like, what is happening here? Like, I don't remember any. And I kept having to restart things because I couldn't remember. And what really made me question it was the quantity of alcohol that I was drinking. My husband was a grad student and I was a very low paid teacher. So we didn't have a ton of money. So I had switched to vodka to save money. And the quantity that I was drinking made me question it. I was like, this is a ton of alcohol that you're having every day, and you're having, like, you're not remembering what you're doing at night. And then I started thinking, like, okay, well, I'll just drink less. I'll moderate. Mm-hmm. Famous last words.
Yes.
And I tried to moderate for 5 years, even though I had a 0% success rate in moderating. And that's where the research project started. I really thought, like, I'll be the one to figure this thing out. Like, thousands of years of people trying to moderate, they have failed, but I'm going to be the one that's going to figure this out finally.
Yeah.
And then I started questioning, like, am I an alcoholic? How do you know? I started having more awareness of other people's drinking and how mine was different and how people didn't seem to black out and throw up on the sidewalk like me. Actually, nobody did that. And I'm like, does that mean I'm an alcoholic? Because I can't stop and I black out. And then I started Googling it and taking all the quizzes and but lying on them so that I didn't get the You know how it is.
I know exactly how it is. Yes. Been there, done that. Yeah. It's pretty scary, isn't it? When you do start to see it and start to think, wow, other people do it differently. What's even harder sometimes is if your social groups are like that also, but then, yeah, but still it's not feeling right within yourself. Was your husband or your partner at the time, was he kind of concerned about the blackout drinking and he didn't notice, or he just wasn't worried?
So my husband grew up with a lot of very heavy drinkers, like daily, very heavy drinkers, like everybody around him. So he genuinely thought that's what adults do. So he didn't think I was doing anything wrong. He actually said to me in my sobriety a couple years ago, he was like, you never blacked out. And I'm like, dude, it was all the time, like one or more times per week, every week. And you didn't even know I was blacked out. Like, I must have been really good at the next day recon where you try to like get the information.
Yes. Oh, totally. That trying to get the information is, oh God.
And see who's mad at you. Or if you need to apologize.
Yeah, cringe. Talk about your bum going tight. It's like, oh, yes, yes. Oh, my gosh. All right. So how much were you drinking, Jill, at that point?
I would make these Cosmos, but I would make them in a pint glass, and it
Oh.
would.
Shit.
And it was like, honestly, like s at least 75% vodka, like most of the glass. And then I would put triple sec in there, and then like a splash of diet cranberry. And what happened is I started having two of those a night. And that's when the consequences, like once I started doing that and my tolerance got really high, then I noticed like, whoa, this is a, you're drinking a lot. So it was the vodka that really helped me realize it, but
Wow.
also probably accelerated it.
Yeah, that just sounds purely medicinal. When you're drinking like that amount and drinking a cosmopolitan basically in a bucket, it's
Yeah, that's not fun. People don't go out and they're like, give me a Cosmo and a bucket, please. That's almost all alcohol. And I would like to drink it alone on my couch. Thank you very much.
Yeah, there's nothing Carrie Bradshaw about that. It's purely
Nope.
medicinal. No. Oh my gosh. Okay, so tell us about the breaking point where you decided, no, this is the moderating's not going to work.
I
Is it up?
stayed dedicated for a very long time to moderation. I tried every strategy I could think of. Every single one, everything I read online, I tried them multiple times and they did not work. And I started to hate myself because they didn't work. And I thought that it was my fault. I thought I was a loser that let that happen to me. I saw my husband being able to control his drinking and my brother and the other people that I like hung out with. They didn't seem to have the same experience. I still believed like that they drink a lot, but no one seemed to have consequences. So I really internalized it as I am bad. I'm a loser because I can't control my drinking. And I would just beat the crap out of myself so hard. Like I developed anxiety, first of all. That's not a problem that I had before the end of my drinking, and it would keep me up all night, like that middle of the night jolt. And then at the very end, I started forcing myself to stay awake for 3 or 4 hours until the sun came up, just thinking about what a piece of crap loser I am and a bad person, and punishing myself really for not moderating. So stupid. That I deserve that kind of punishment. And
Wow.
the thoughts got really scary at the end. I started having suicidal thoughts and thinking about, like, my husband doesn't deserve this kind of crap. Like, why are you doing this to him? You should set him free, like that kind of stuff. And I would start my day by looking in the mirror. And just repeating, I hate you, I hate you, I hate, like over and over, and make myself cry. Like it was so bad. And now I'm like, people think that drinkers are these selfish people that like just like to have fun. That's not, no one thinks that's fun. And it was those scary thoughts that finally did it. I realized, like, you're gonna do something about this someday when you're drunk. And I decided that I should not drink for 90 days. So while all this craziness was going on, my husband was up with me, trying to help me and comfort me. So he was also getting no sleep. So I looked at him and I was like, I'm not drinking for 90 days. But I had no intention of being sober, no interest, because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want people to call me that. I wanted to be cured because I just had a bad habit, okay? I just had very high tolerance. I was in this routine that I needed to break, and then I would be fine. That was the problem. People like me don't have to be alcoholics and be sober. So I did the 90 days, and then day 91 was my 29th birthday, actually. So I thought it was a sign from the universe that I can moderate. So I drank on my birthday. And then I did moderate for 2 months for the first time ever in my life, because I isolated and like really controlled it and would not socialize. But then we went on vacation and we had the drink package, and it just like all, and then the same stuff when I came home from that vacation, exactly the same, the scary thoughts, the anxiety, not letting myself sleep, the hatred. And I suffered for 4 more months before I accepted. And I looked over at my husband again in the morning after keeping us all up. And I was like, I can never drink ever again. And I felt like it was scary. And I felt like I must be a loser and a failure. And all, but I also felt at peace with the decision. I was like, maybe this all can end. And if they want to call me an alcoholic, fine. But I just can't. This is going to end if I stop. So it was very peaceful.
Yeah, I think that's what happens when you just get to that point where you realize the moderating is just not going to work, and just let's just give it up. Yep. There is some peace in it, isn't there? And that, I think the moderation just can create so much more tension in our bodies. That is when the berating of myself, and sounds like you as well, when that really started, just like, see, you can't, what's wrong with you? Everything you said, I could just so relate to so much of what you said. It's so awful the way that we treat ourselves because of alcohol, because we're kind of not blaming the alcohol, we're blaming ourselves. What is it from a neuroscience perspective as to why some of us can't moderate and others can?
There's a lot of reasons why some people can't. The way that I like to think about it is risk factors versus resilience factors. And I had a lot of those through my story that I described. And that's what makes you more vulnerable to relying on alcohol to cope. I think what eventually happens, either this is a deficiency that makes us more vulnerable and then alcohol enhances it, is there's actually like a stop pathway in your brain. And when you're faced with a decision, your brain looks at it and it's either like, okay, go do the decision, or either stop or like wait and see. And that wait or stop path can be weaker in some people than others. And the more you drink, the weaker it gets. That's why some people, maybe they were moderate drinkers, and then they eventually start losing their off switch. It weakens, and your ability to say no, despite good intentions or what you have to do the next day, it goes away and your reward system takes over. Alcohol also keeps us stuck in our reactive, primitive brain. So we can't use good decision-making skills anymore. Like your brain almost stops working. Like you can't think things through. You're in a fog. You just react to everything around you. Also, people that struggle with alcohol, we usually have an attentional bias on alcohol, so our attention gets stuck on it and we can't redirect. And you might not even notice that it's happening. But the best example of it is like when you quit drinking and you walk in a room, you'll know where the alcohol is. Like you'll be able to instantly zone in on it. And that's this attentional bias that's getting activated. But the problem is that makes us get stuck on our cues as well, and we can't redirect. So things will sit with us longer, the things that are telling us that we need a drink. And alcohol feels better for some people than others. And it felt really good for me. And trauma can make it feel better too, because trauma changes the brain. But some people have a drink and they're like, meh, okay, like whatever, that's fine. Other people have a drink and it's like, oh my gosh, like, what is this? This is the best thing I've ever had in my life. Like when I started drinking again on my birthday, I almost cried at the pleasure and loveliness of that first sip of wine. Most people don't do that. That's kind of weird. So all of these experiences make it really hard to say no once you've had any amount of alcohol. You just want to keep going and going and going and going because it just seems like a great idea.
Yes. And it's like that doesn't really change in us. It's funny when you said that because I think for myself, I have that with anything that's high dopamine. So whether it was, I remember once going to the casino once and only once because I won heaps of money and then lost it all and then more until I had no money left in my bank account. Yeah. I'd get the can't stops. I call it with the alcohol. I just get the can't stops. I can't stop. And the same is if we started to take drugs, recreational drugs. It was my obsession all night. It was to get more. Or has it kicked in yet? Oh, no, it's wearing off. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It was like it's so obsessional. And, yeah, that's really interesting. And I wonder if that is a trauma response. It's just – but do you think it's not just alcohol? Like it could be just high dopamine things that do that?
Yeah, so what you were saying about dopamine is very accurate. So most people think that dopamine is about pleasure. It's not a pleasure molecule. It's actually designed to help you remember pleasurable experiences so you can get them again.
Oh, wow.
So animals, for example, that don't have any dopamine, they will just sit and do nothing and starve to death. And even if you put food like 1 inch away, they will not be motivated to go get it and they will die.
Yes.
And so it's a motivational chemical and it's responsible for cravings. So when you go to the bar and you order your drink, you start having the effects of alcohol before drinking it. The anticipation, that's all dopamine. So when you're gambling or drinking or waiting for that edible to kick in or whatever, your brain is releasing dopamine, not to give you pleasure, but to give you motivation to seek out the thing that gives you pleasure. And alcohol changes the brain. It releases way more dopamine than anything else, anything natural. So it's a high amount of motivation that's getting dumped into your brain when you have a cue. And then that sets off a craving. And then combine that with having our attention getting stuck on alcohol and not being able to redirect. And you just like can't control yourself. So it actually causes seeking behavior. It makes you seek out rewards.
Yes. So that's why at the end of the night, you're into the cooking wine.
I used to have this bottle. My husband bought it and I was so mad at him because at the time I only bought small amounts of alcohol, like what I would drink that day. He bought this huge, like 80 liter bottle of whiskey. And you know who was drinking it all? Me. Because after I finished the amount that I bought for the day, I'd be like, oh, I'll just have a splash. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go in and pour just straight whiskey. I didn't even put anything in it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it does make you dig in. It makes you want to find anything that you can.
Yes.
Because you
yes.
have a big craving. You're very motivated to get your reward.
Oh, it's so amazing. So when people go from, say, having 10 years of abstinence and then they go back to having one drink, but then boom, it's on and they're back into the cooking wine two weeks later. Is it the neural pathway or what specifically in the brain hasn't changed? Is it the dopamine receptors? What is that?
So we build very powerful associations with alcohol. We think that it's good for stress, for winding down. We just literally anything is good with alcohol. Any emotion, you can feel less of it, more of it, something different. So we have a lot of cues for drinking. So if you imagine your brain, there's like a cue and then it's linked to alcohol. Over time, what happens as we reinforce that pathway over and over and over, your brain, because it's just trying to help you out, it looks for earlier predictors of the reward. So before, where you might get the dopamine release when you're at the bar waiting for your drink, now you get it at 5 o'clock because you know you're going to be going to the bar soon. And then, so your dopamine starts getting released at five to anticipate the whole rest of the path, and then so on and so on. So it builds out all of these big, long pathways that are cues to motivate you to get your reward, because it thinks that reward is essential for our survival. If it releases that much dopamine, it must be good for us. Mm-hmm. So when you quit, even if you have 10 years of sobriety and you're reinforcing like, oh, when I'm anxious, I can go on a walk. When I'm stressed, I can use this coping skill. I can go to the gym. I can do a meditation. Even though you're reinforcing these alternative paths, the original one never goes away. It just gets dusty. So once you drink again, you reactivate all that crap in your brain. Like the attention, aka the obsession. You think about it all the time. You have some vulnerabilities probably with your ability to stop once you've started, and you remember that you used to use it for coping. So then you reactivate the pathways, and it happens really fast. Like for me, I did those 90 days and then I moderated for 2 months because I really like focused on isolating myself and like doing everything exactly right. But as soon as I had that first opportunity, the pathways were like, bam, like, let's go. Mm-hmm. And then I was right back to where I was at the end. Mm-hmm. That is why, like, forever, you have to, there's no hope, no moderation is possible.
Yes, great. Someone said it finally, because you see some people talking about moderation, and I know some people can do it, but I wonder to what extent their obsession with the alcohol was. And now that you've said that too, about that kind of attention, that obsessive nature in which we kind of crave that pleasure, makes a lot more sense as well. And also, I think as soon as that pathway is reopened, the dopamine dump is so high, that reward is so high, that the brain's just going to go ding, 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 I want that. And, yep. And we're back. So it's not about us being weak. It's just that our brains are just wanting that dopamine because it feels good. And yeah, it's your a great brain, motivator.
Yep. Your brain isn't linking the after stuff, all the misery. It's linking the before stuff. Its only concern for you is to get this thing that's important for your survival, which is what dopamine is for. It's to motivate us to seek out things that are good for our survival. That's why eating is pleasurable and sleeping feels good. So it never connects the end of the story. So why would I, if I was stressed, why would I go on a stupid walk that takes a long time to work when I could just have a drink and instantly have my problem be fixed? In quotes, doesn't fix it.
Yeah.
So the brain is like, why wouldn't you just do this? This path is so much easier and better. And you've done it a million times. So why wouldn't you just do that? Why would you use this one that takes effort?
Yes, of course. Yes. It just makes so much sense, especially when you explain it like that. I remember reading that thing about the rats in Dopamine Nation, where she said if they had no dopamine, they'd put the food right in front of them and they just wouldn't eat. That was just mind-blowing as well.
Yep.
And also how she talked about with gamblers, they would have a dopamine dump even if they lost. Incredible. So even if they lost an amount of money, there was still that same anticipation. And it's, again, it's that motivator, isn't it? It's that thing that keeps you going.
Yeah, the issue, this is something like I'm currently learning about, so I don't really have all the answers, but there are consequences to some things like drinking or gambling. And what is supposed to happen, you do the thing, you get a reward, and your brain is like, ooh, great, I'll remember this. Or you do the thing, you have a consequence happen, and your brain is like, oh, I'll adjust. Mm-hmm. And if the consequence keeps happening, it kind of like breaks the tie and you're like, that thing isn't rewarding. Frick that thing. But that doesn't happen with drinkers. Like the consequences don't impact what the brain is thinking about alcohol. Like even when you repeat the same behavior, even when I was doing it daily and I was having the consequences daily, it was not impacting the anticipation and how great I thought alcohol was. So that's not a weakness either. Like we beat ourselves up. Why aren't I learning? For especially like the chronic relapsers, why can't I learn? Like I want this so bad. It's because those things, like we know they happen, but they're not really impacting the brain. They're not impacting that path.
So what is it that makes us kind of wake up to go, oh no, this is like, I guess, is it just that for you? What was it that made you go, okay, that's it. It's impacting me now. The consequences are too great. And my brain's actually starting to realize that now.
So there's goal-directed thinking where you think, oh, my goal is to, I don't know, be happy or healthy. So in order to be healthy, I need to eat kale and go to the gym, even though I don't want to do those things. Or there's automatic thinking where it's just like, oh, it's 5 o'clock. Well, a good time to drink. Drinking keeps you in the automatic mode. But what can happen is when your suffering is so great, you can get shocked out of it, shocked out of your denial, and your goal-directed circuit can like come back to life. And then you can start like, whoa, why was I doing that? Like, I can't believe I did that for 5 years and tried to moderate even though I didn't moderate. And that's when people will kind of have that epiphany when their brain is like shocked out of denial and it turns back on. So that's like AKA your rock bottom moment. Everybody has a different threshold though. Like your rock bottom moment is not mine. And some people's is very simple. It's like just another hangover on a Monday. And they're like, what? Like, why is this? Why do I keep doing this? And then they're like shocked out of it and it clicks for them finally. Mm-hmm. So you never know what your version of that is, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of what happens is your brain like is able to come back online and help you think more long term instead of just behaving automatically. But like you get a stimuli and then your brain's like alcohol and then you drink and then you have your consequences and then you just repeat, repeat, repeat forever without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to get people to move from that automatic process into like a process where they can think things through and pause.
Yeah, 100%. And it really is, isn't it, that moment where you kind of realize the suffering this is causing me and the discomfort is now actually much greater than the reward that I was getting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, like this is not worth it anymore. I don't want to live another second like this.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So when you decided to stop, when you decided, right, that's it, enough's enough, how did it look for you, like the coping mechanisms? What did you do when you felt stressed and couldn't cope?
So I started listening to podcasts right away because it was private. I could just do it and no one would know.
Yeah.
I thought that I was different from other people and I didn't need support. So I had a big ego that I brought right into it. And because of that, I was very emotional and reactive and I would get very angry. And 4 months into my sobriety is when the world shut down and I was sent home from work. So I thought like, this is a good opportunity to do therapy again. And that's when I started learning coping skills and understanding like why I was feeling the way that I was feeling and connecting the dots. But it took a lot of practice and I was coming from none. So I had to learn a lot. The first one that I ever learned was just walking it off. Like if you're really overwhelmed and upset, you just go on a rage walk and you walk it off until you feel better. And that's a very easy one. And now I know strategies to kind of manage my stress so things don't build,
mm-hmm.
and take care of myself and set boundaries so there aren't less resentments and a more proactive things. But it took years. It was a lot of work to both understand myself and learn how to navigate all of these overwhelming emotions.
Yeah, 100%. What were you angry about in that first 4 months?
I was angry that other people could drink and I couldn't. That was a big one. I was also angry that no one helped me. I had that resentment for like a year. That was a really hard one to work through. Like at the end, I was asking for help. Like I wanted it to stop and I couldn't make it stop. And I felt like the people closest to me knew how bad it was. I mean, they saw it, like they saw some bad stuff, some very embarrassing, out of control moments. And I felt like people just observed me blowing up my life and didn't try to intervene. And now I recognize, like, first of all, they probably didn't know what to do. They're probably in denial too about me having a problem. And third, like, I honestly probably wouldn't have listened to them if they tried to help. But that was a really big one for me. I felt embarrassed that I had drank for so long. I mean, for me, like it was 7 years from start to finish. But I felt like I threw my whole 20s in the trash. And I was really mad about that. And it took a lot of time for me to let that one go.
Were you mad as well about the bullying and that past stuff as well? Was that also part of that anger and that rage?
I feel like the bullying I kind of mostly dropped as I got older. I had a lot of anger triggers that I didn't understand. I was very angry all the time because I would go get bullied and then I would come home to a home that I didn't like being in. And I had a very bad relationship with my dad. Like I could not stand him.
Wow.
Because of how he treated my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was angry like 100% of the time growing up, which also made me really vulnerable to developing a problem. So all of that anger just kind of rushed back in, like feeling like my life was unfair, feeling like it was out of control, like no one appreciated me, like I could never just get a break. All of those same feelings came in. But when I first quit, I felt like I had a bunch of rage for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand, like it was old stuff. Because really what I didn't think I drank to cope. I thought that I just liked to have fun, even though it wasn't fun. But I didn't realize that I was a very, very angry person up until I started drinking and then the anger went away.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like get that until I started working on it. The rage in the beginning was very, very tough to navigate because it was so overpowering because I hadn't felt or allowed myself to feel in years, more years than when I had been drinking because I tried to control my emotions in other ways before that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's intimidating when feelings start coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially ones like anger, because they feel this shame attached with anger. It's so intense. Like it's body stuff, like your heart's racing and you're sweating and it's quite intense. I find with myself, if I have an anger spike, it's really quite intense. And I used to be really reactive, but now I try and, you know, breathe my way back down into my window of tolerance, but then I dip and then I go into this really, like, I just like almost like depressive, almost like just shut down for a bit. And until I sort of come back up again, it's like this woo, boof, like that. It's really intense. Our anger is so intense. Yeah. Like I love what you just said, the rage walk. That is so awesome, just to get out there and go for a walk and to feel those emotions, to welcome in those feelings of anger. What would you do? What was part of the process apart from the walking? Was it just experiencing them in your body, or how did it look for you?
I knew no matter what, I couldn't take a shortcut, like drinking it away. So that just forced me to, they weren't welcome, but they were accepted. Like, yeah, I guess you can hang out here, like, if you have to, but I'd rather you not, kind of situation. So I knew that I couldn't do anything to make it go away. So I just like endured it and then eventually learned skills. When I really decided to stop, like I committed, like forever, I will never drink again. I accepted it. I knew like I'm not gonna do other things to try to numb or cope. Like I don't wanna live that life anymore. So, and I didn't know like any of that was normal, like being highly emotional in the beginning. So I just really tolerated it. I mean, sometimes I wasn't the most pleasant person to be around, but I accepted its presence. And I think that's now looking back, that's a huge skill. I wouldn't say I was non-reactive. I would indulge the negative emotion and like hype myself up about, yeah, that person sucks. They're so mean. They're so ungrateful. How could they do that to you? I'd really get into it, but I wouldn't make it go away anymore.
Yeah. Do you feel like that's also could be addictive as well, those anger emotions, because they're so heightened?
Yeah, anger makes you feel powerful. I'm a very shame-prone person. Obviously, from just the way that how I grew up and then how I behaved when I was drinking. But when you feel shame, you feel very vulnerable and small. And we don't like to feel that way. So we get angry. So we don't have to anymore. And it does hype you up and it makes you energized and feel powerful and in control, but you're really not any of those things. So it's a good way to hide from things. Whatever you were feeling is now gone because you got angry.
Yes, oh my God, so true. Yeah, it does give you a sense of being big and powerful and in control. Wow, that's amazing. And so how does it look for you now? Like when you do you still feel angry? What do you do with it when it shows up?
I do still get angry. I still identify as an angry person. People always say they can't imagine it, but I think my fellow angry people can see it in my heart. I do get very angry. I've had some moments in my sobriety. Those are the only times I ever want to drink, is when I'm just really pissed. And it feels like the world is so unfair. How could this thing happen to me? How could that person do that? And then that makes me so angry that I just want to drink. Now, when I get angry, I can reframe. I can have empathy for other people. I don't make it all about me anymore. I don't take things personally. Like I feel the anger, and then I'm able to like mold it in my brain and reason with it and then calm down. And use like the rage walk if it's very, very intense, like use coping skills like that. But if it's just starting to happen and I can catch it before it escalates into big anger, I can reason with it and talk myself down and bring in other strategies like empathy, I said, to lessen it and to redirect.
What to do with the part that feels so, it's sort of like I'm seeing it in parts here. So the part of you that feels vulnerable, and then that anger kicks in, I guess, to protect that vulnerable part. And then the anger's, I guess, stops working, or that feels so intense that we want to dull that down. So once we've dealt with the anger, I'm just thinking about myself here too in this cycle that I go on. Once you've dealt with the anger and that's gone, what happens with this guy here, the part that felt vulnerable in the first place? Do you
You
get
have to
there?
work on that part. That's where the work is. And it's very unpleasant because no one wants to work on things that make them feel very vulnerable and small. For me, it was self-worth and self-esteem work. I didn't like myself. I thought that I sucked. And I like it got better when I stopped drinking, obviously, because I wasn't disappointing myself every day. But I never had self-esteem ever
No
in my
wonder.
life, except when I was like 9 or under, but I don't know if that counts. So I had to learn first to not hate myself, then to like myself, and now I think I'm like pretty great. I would say. Sometimes I do things and I'm like, ugh, cringe. Like, why did you say that? But I don't beat the crap out of myself anymore. So it's, you have to first treat the anger so you're not explosive all the time. And then you can start to see this vulnerable thing for what it actually is. Because like I said, when you get angry, you stop feeling whatever the other thing is. So you don't even know what it is. You have no idea. So you have to first discover it. And then the more you work on that, the less the anger is going to happen.
So true, isn't it? Because I think under the anger is always usually fear. Well, it's definitely in my case, there's a fear there.
Yeah, fear, pain,
yeah. Shame. And it's, 100%. And it's all about trying to protect that vulnerable part of myself. If I get big and puffy enough, then nothing's going to hurt that little part, that tender part in me. But it's the tender part that needs the work and the holding. And yes, it's big work. Ooh, I love it.
Not
I love
fun,
it.
But worth it.
Yeah, and also understanding. I think when we peel the layers back and we can actually work on those vulnerable parts that we've been trying so hard to protect through anger, through drinking, whatever coping mechanism we use, there's so much understanding in it. Well, I find anyway that just it's tender in there and it's a beautiful place to sit and be with when we can just look at it and hold it and be with those parts. Oh, I love it. I love that work though. But I was scared of it too. I was so scared of it. But yeah, tell us about the work that you're doing at the moment and the work that you're doing with people.
Yeah, so I run anger management programs for anyone that's an angry person, men and women, and we work on exactly what I was talking about, empathy, destructive thinking. I also kind of teach them what's going on in their brain when they get angry. We work on that vulnerable part, the shame, judgment of others and ourselves, assertive communication and boundaries, all these skills that really help that vulnerable part get bigger.
Oh, wow.
And more brave.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's like my main, I'm very excited about that work right now because when I was angry, I was looking it up, anger management, and couldn't find anything about it. So I just like stayed angry and had to figure it out.
Yes. And look, the other thing is too, I think with quitting alcohol, it's such a small component of the bigger thing that's actually the problem here. So if you peel back the layers, what we're really talking about is dealing with the vulnerabilities. And so that is what it is that you're offering. And that's some really deep healing stuff. Like that's pretty awesome. What an offering.
Yeah, it's really fun to see when it starts working for people. When they have anger, they still go up and have the big intense anger, but then they can think about it and reframe it and bring in their tools. And eventually the more you do that, the less like big your anger gets because you can manage it. The whole thing about anger management is like, we think we're going from like 0 to 100, like we're fine. And then something happens and we're pissed. It's really not. And if you can identify earlier and earlier in the process before you escalate to getting really angry, you can deal with it then instead of letting it build. It's a lot of awareness work as well, which is the same for drinking, really. It's all the same. You just change the label from anger to sobriety.
Oh, 100%. Unbelievable. That's so great. And what does it look like? Is it a course or is it one on like with groups or one on one?
Yeah, so I have a big training once a week where I teach and then I teach skills. And then a second time in the week, I meet with a small group of women and then I meet with my small group of men and we review their anger together, like actual anger instances and work on, like you have to bring one specific instance of anger to the meeting to work on.
Wow, that is awesome. That is so awesome. Amazing. And can people in Australia access that as well?
Oh, yeah, everybody.
Time-wise, that would work out?
Time might be hard. I try to, every time I do it, I try to change the time. The trainings always have replays and everything, but the small groups, I try to always vary the times for working people, different time zone people.
Amazing. Fantastic. Oh, Jill, that's so awesome. There's so many things, but I'm aware of the time and I don't want to piss you off. That was a joke.
I'll cope with it.
Yes, you go on a range walk. So beautiful. What an amazing story. So 4 years sober. It's absolutely awesome. Obviously, you're getting yourself into a really great place and you're learning so much and you're just continuing to evolve as a human being. How is life, if you compare the two versions of yourself, where you are now and where you were back then, how does it feel to look at those two differences?
Completely different person. Like, I never thought that I could get here. I'm calm. I like myself. I have real confidence. It's not fake. It's not ego. And I'm just very relaxed. I feel hope for the future, where before I just focused on things that I thought would make me feel good, career success, getting a PhD, all of these other things that I thought if I could do that, then I would be good. And I was always just overwhelmed and miserable. So I think the best thing about sobriety is actually liking myself now and not being in that dark place.
Yeah, same. 100%. It's beautiful, isn't it? If you could go back and speak to your 22-year-old self, what would you say?
I would say, dude, you need some very intensive therapy, not the therapy you're in. Like, some big therapy, because it's about to get bad. It is, I don't know. That's such a hard, I'm always so weird about that question. Like, do you want to tell your younger self what to expect? Do you want to try to prevent it from happening? Because if none of that stuff happened, I wouldn't be who I am now.
Yeah.
So it's always hard. I might just be like, you got this. Things suck. Because they did at 22. Things suck, but I promise you one day they won't. That's probably what I would say. Long, rambly answer to get to the point.
No, that's great. I love that. What would you say, Jill, to kids that are being bullied or for parents that are experiencing children? Because I see that a lot. For kids that are being bullied at the moment, how could they respond and help their teenager that might be being bullied
Definitely
at the moment?
Intervene in some way, whether that's talking to the school, changing schools, get that kid into therapy so they can learn how to cope. For me, my parents wanted to talk to the school and they wanted to move because it got so bad, but no, I can handle it. Like, I didn't want to inconvenience anybody. So I think you really just have to step up and intervene in a way that's respectful to your kid, but don't just let them handle it, because they'll probably handle it in a negative way. Because a lot of times we don't have these skills to cope when we're young, and we internalize all of it and make it about us. And then we reach for quick fixes to fix it.
100%. Yeah. And just to allow that child, I think, as well, to talk. It sounds like you didn't have a safe place to kind of come home and land and to talk about what you were feeling, what you're experiencing, perhaps.
Yeah, really listen. And whenever I run, like, especially an anger group, but even if I'm like doing a meeting for sober people, I'm very like adamant. No look on the bright side. No, like, oh, you could have it worse. That stuff really just kills someone who wants to talk to you. It makes them feel more isolated. So I think being that safe space without trying to tell them like it's not that bad, validation is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Validation's everything. I think that's what we probably needed, our younger selves would have needed.
Yeah,
and we
really.
Still do need now, right? Oh, Jill Teets, I could just talk to you all day. Oh my gosh, thank you so much for your time today. And if people want to reach out to you, you're on Instagram at SoberPowered. Correct.
Yep, sober powered. If you search that, you'll find me.
I'll put links in the show notes of how you can reach out to Jill. Also tune into the Sober Powered podcast as well. Loads of great information on there for people to learn from you and to hear what you've got to offer, I think is awesome. Thank you for all the work that you're doing. It's amazing. And I just want you to know I really like you and that I think you don't suck.
Oh, thank you. I like you too.
Thank you,
Look
Jill.
At us accepting compliments
I
without
know.
Deflecting.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
It is.
Oh, Jill, thank you so much for your time today. You're amazing. Thank you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.